This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to talk about treating severe mental illness. Medical journalist Robert Whitaker is our guest. He's the author of A New History of Mental Illness, Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. Whitaker says his interest in the topic began a few years ago when he stumbled onto a line of study of the biology of schizophrenia and findings by the World Health Organization that outcomes for people in the U.S. diagnosed with schizophrenia have worsened over the past 25 years. Whitaker begins his book with a history of cures, from asylums where the ill were seen as brutes to the years when lobotomies were performed and through the drug therapies of today. He also questions the diagnosis of schizophrenia itself. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, our number. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Whitaker has written extensively on the mentally ill and the drug industry for the Boston Globe. He's won awards for his work, including the George Polk Award for medical writing. Again, the telephone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Whitaker, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me today.
I'd like you to tell us first about the information you came across that launched the reporting for this book. The information that you came across that you refer to in the preface as an unusual line of psychiatric research involving the study of the biology of schizophrenia.
Right. This I stumbled across in the spring of 1998, and it is a almost bizarre line of research that began in 1950. What happened was this, is that researchers, of course, trying to study the biology of an illness, want to model that illness, and usually they do so in animals. However, psychosis is pretty hard to model in animals. So what American researchers started doing in 1950 and continued doing so until 1998, which is when I stumbled onto it, was basically they would model psychosis in mentally ill patients. And what this meant is they would give their mentally ill patients, people ill with schizophrenia, drugs designed to make them worse. So, for example, in the 1950s, they would give them drugs like LSD and mescaline. And the idea was that if you understood in what way that those drugs worked on the brain, say those drugs, for example, may have released dopamine, therefore you had a model for what might be going wrong in the brain. And then later what they turned to was amphetamines, methylphenidate, ketamine. And what was so bizarre about this line of research was in very calm tones in the best medical journals in the United States, some of the best, you would see these reports where doctors would talk about how patients had come into emergency rooms looking for help, seeking help, sometimes first episode patients who, 17, 18, 19 years of age, and instead of being given help in some way tried to help that would help them, calm down and get in and sort of relieve some of the incredible fears they were going through and hopefully ease their psychotic symptoms, they were given drugs like methylphenidate expected to make them worse, expected to make them much worse. And that was the first thing. And then when I, of course, looked at the consent forms for these odd experiments, I found that the researchers were not telling the truth to their patients or to the families.
Mm. What were they telling them?
Well, it's really heartbreaking. If you look in the consent forms, they would say the purpose of their experiments were to study the disease process, and sometimes they would even say a drug like ketamine, for example, which is known to stir, hallucinations, and even in sort of people who are not suffering psychosis, they'd say this experiment is designed to test a medication named ketamine. And they would even promise in the side effects that at the dosages we're giving you, there will be no sort of alteration of sensory experience, et cetera, when in fact they expected them to get much worse in a variety of ways. So it's really a betrayal of a group of people that, you think that was the sort of thing that went on in experiments in the dark ages here in the U.S., but here it was going on until 1998.
Why did it come to an end?
Well, actually, that was one of the good things about the Globe series, which I co-wrote with another Globe person named Dolores Kong. And after we brought attention to it, basically there was an investigation by the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, and the head of that, the director of the NIMH, Steve Hyman at that time, basically shut down experiments of this type. And I believe they've basically come to a complete halt now.
Also, at the outset of the book, you tell readers about the findings of the World Health Organization that are pretty interesting regarding the treatment of schizophrenia in the developing world versus in the West. Tell us about that.
Right, and this is actually was a sideline to that, you know, the series on experimental abuses. But as I was doing that research, I kept coming upon these outcome studies that were just mind-boggling. The first were repeated studies by the World Health Organization that were conducted all the way starting in the 1969 and then through the 70s and 80s, which found that outcomes for schizophrenia patients in the U.S. and other rich countries were markedly worse than in the poor countries of the world, like India and Nigeria. And the differences were dramatic in a really telling way. What they found in the poor countries was that about 40% of the patients diagnosed with the first episode of schizophrenia, and diagnosed, by the way, by Western doctors and by Western standards, would basically recover in a two-year period to where they were unimpaired. They were just basically recovered and enjoying very good social outcomes. Another 25% might have had a second episode of psychosis or a third episode of psychosis, but it was sort of an episodic illness. And in between episodes, they were returning to a full remission of symptoms, in other words, what they call their premorbid status. And then only about a third of the patients there in the poor countries were becoming chronically ill. Whereas here in the rich countries, U.S. and other rich countries, the overwhelming majority of patients were becoming chronically ill, and you had very low recovery rates, so much so that the WHO concluded, the WHO is the World Health Organization, concluded that living in a developed country like the U.S., was, quote, a strong predictor that a patient would never fully recover. Well, I was just stunned by this sort of evidence of, you know, we usually think of the prowess of our medicine, and here clearly was an example of something different, of sort of, you know, failure. And this was sort of buried in the WHO results, but it was notable that there was a remarkable difference in the medical care, and the difference was this. It's here in the U.S., of course, and the other rich countries, the therapeutic goal is to keep patients continually on the antipsychotic medications. Whereas in the poor countries, that isn't so. They may use the medications on a temporary basis to stabilize patients, but they do not keep them on the medications. Only about 1 in 6 patients is kept on the medications. So you had this difference in the use of medications, and for whatever reason, the better outcomes were in the poor countries. There was one other thing, by the way, that also attracted my interest, and that was an outcome study by Harvard researchers reported in 1994, which found that long-term outcomes for schizophrenia patients in the U.S. were no better today in the 1880s and early 1990s than they were in 1900, when the therapeutic of the day was basically wrapping the insane in wet sheets. So my curiosity was aroused in the sense that you know, we keep hearing about how our improvements for mental illness, severe mental illness, schizophrenia, have made dramatic strides in the past 50 years, and yet it wasn't showing up in these outcome studies. And that was sort of the conundrum and failure that I set out to investigate.
Yeah. Now, I want to make sure I'm clear on this and do the same for our listeners.
Sure.
The diagnosis of schizophrenia the diagnoses that were made for this World Health Organization study or studies were made by Western doctors in these developing nations?
That's correct.
Okay.
And because what happened was diagnosis became a critical question. When they first reported after their first study, the first study had compared outcomes across 8 countries, and when they reported the better outcomes, when the WHO reported the better outcomes, Western doctors as a whole said, no way, this is impossible. It's got to be a difference in diagnosis. You're misdiagnosing this. And what is being seen as diagnosed as schizophrenia in the poor countries must be something else, even though it was a Western-driven study. So the World Health Organization said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go back and look at this diagnostic question and outcomes. And we're even going to sort of categorize these newly, and by the way, in the second study, they were only looking at newly diagnosed patients, okay, coming in for a first episode of psychosis. And they said, we're going to look at subcategories of patients, schizophrenia patients, because there's different sort of subgroups within schizophrenia. And we're going to compare outcomes in these subgroups as well. And so what they found is it didn't matter that even in these, if you started breaking apart these diagnostics by different subgroups, you still got the better outcomes across the different subgroups as well. So yes, it was diagnoses made by Western doctors, by Western standards, and they looked at this question repeatedly.
How is schizophrenia defined?
Oh, that's a great question and a loaded question, and it's so misunderstood. First of all, and I'm going to start today, and the problem is the diagnosis and the definition really has changed over time. It's quite different than what it was, say, in 1910, 1920. And actually what happened is it became a much looser diagnosis in the 1950s and 1960s than it was before, and then it was tightened up some in the 1970s and 1980s. But here's the key thing today. We think of schizophrenia in the popular culture as a discrete disorder, that it's one discrete disease. Actually, it's a definition used to describe symptoms of various types, and people have quite different symptoms who are diagnosed with schizophrenia. For example, some people are very paranoid. Some people hear voices. Some people are very socially withdrawn. So there can be these quite different responses, and yet they all get sort of lumped into this category of schizophrenic. And so really, when you get away from sort of the public dialogue, people talk about the group of schizophrenias as opposed to an individual discrete disorder called schizophrenia.
How is it diagnosed?
Well, it's diagnosed. There's no biological, test for it. It's diagnosed just by looking at the symptoms. So, for example, has someone been hearing voices for 6 months? Well, that starts to become a symptom that is seen as diagnosable as schizophrenia. People can even just behave in very silly, sort of childish manner, and that can lead to a diagnosis of schizophrenia. So it is based totally on the symptoms. There's a chart of symptoms. Extreme withdrawal can be seen as schizophrenia. And so basically they just check off these, are there present symptoms that fit the current definition of schizophrenia? But again, there's a number of symptoms listed, and people do not have to have all of them. So you can get people behaving in quite different ways and struggling with their minds in quite different manners, and still they will both be diagnosed as with schizophrenia.
Now, there are tools now, diagnostic tools, that can let us look into the brain, CAT scans and MRIs and the like. Are these being used in the study of mental illness, and are they being used at all in diagnosis?
Right. By the way, I want to add one thing. It was well acknowledged in the U.S. in the 1970s and 1980s that American doctors were way over-diagnosing schizophrenia, and various studies found that really only, in one study, for example, said that really only about 16% of patients in a certain hospital who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia really had the symptoms of schizophrenia. So it's been a diagnostic label that's been applied sometimes with much too loosely. Now, your question about the use of imaging studies and imaging technology, it is not being used for diagnostic purposes. It is being used to study, the brains of people so diagnosed, and the idea is, can you find some sort of biological abnormality that maybe you can tie to symptoms? And there's been some progress on this. However, it's this whole effort to find the biological causes of psychosis has been one in which there have been, and going back over 100 years, in which there have been continual pronouncements that the biological abnormality of psychosis has been found, and none of them have ever stood up over time. Now, maybe with the new imaging equipment, you'll get some better findings that will stand up over time, but there is today no specific, well-defined abnormality that has been tied to schizophrenia. The other problem that is so problematic with this line of research is this. The drugs that are used to treat schizophrenia do cause changes in the brain, and because people are medicated so quickly, it becomes very difficult for researchers to say, are we looking at changes in the brain that are caused by the disorder or associated with the disorder, or are we seeing changes caused by the drugs? And an example of this, for example, is what happens to the basal ganglia, which is an area of the brain, with this disorder. And people have hypothesized that you get an enlargement of this area of the brain in schizophrenia. And there's some tiny evidence that that is true. In first episode patients, you may get a small bit of enlargement in one of the different structures of the basal ganglia. However, once you put patients on the drugs, you get noticeable enlargement, and that's actually much more pronounced than what you see prior to the drug therapy. So it's a line of inquiry that is very problematic, and frankly, sometimes the researchers make pronouncements that, hey, we've found this biological abnormality in patients with schizophrenia, which upon sort of more close examination doesn't hold up because you can see it as a drug effect.
You mentioned a moment or two ago the overdiagnosis of schizophrenia, and you cited the figure of 16% of those diagnosed as schizophrenic actually had the disease.
Right.
But what about that other 84%? What got them into the pool?
Oh, boy. You know, just sort of behavior that others found disturbing, sometimes manic behavior, sort of difficult behavior. Frankly, there's a lot of bias in diagnosis. So, for example, when people have looked at this, they can find that the diagnostic label is applied much quicker to African-Americans and poor people. So if you're behaving in a difficult manner, a disruptive manner, but perhaps not a criminal manner, and perhaps you're saying things that people find odd or disturbing, and you also happen to be African-American or very poor, you're at a much greater risk of being diagnosed as schizophrenic as opposed to a milder disorder such as manic depressive illness. So that's what researchers found, for example, is that sort of middle-class whites were more likely to be funneled into this category of manic depressive illness, which is a less severe diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that it doesn't exist or anything like that, but clearly there is some cultural bias that becomes part of the diagnosis.
So you don't share the opinion that some hold that mental illness is a myth?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, people clearly can be disturbed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, what the causes of that disturbance are, are unknown. I think that is clear. And my own opinion is that, and this is based on the spectrum of outcomes you see in poor countries, is that, you know, some people may indeed be suffering from a biological disorder, and those are the people who become, chronically ill. There's a second group, I believe, that, to have a sort of a vulnerability to psychosis, and then they can, some sort of emotional stress can trigger their descent into psychosis. And this is the group that maybe you'll see have sort of an episodic course. And then there is this group that in the absence of drug treatment, continual drug treatment, will recover, and it's around 40%. And by the way, and we can go into this, there's been studies in the U.S. that found that same figure. And in those cases, you think that probably the primary trigger really was, there undoubtedly was some sort of biological vulnerability, but some extreme emotional stress was probably involved as well. And when people have looked into, say, the lives of people, say, 6 months and a year before they have a schizophrenic break, there very, very, very often is a recognizable traumatic event, such as abuse of some sort, violence, that sort of thing.
Mm. Now, we've been talking about schizophrenia by and large, although the subtitle of your book includes the words mentally ill. What about other diagnoses of serious mental illness, depression, for example? Do people with life-threatening depression face the same issues as those with schizophrenia?
Well, the classic going back through history was that there were sort of two major classes. There were the depressives, and then there were the psychotic patients. And sometimes they overlapped as well. In terms of severe depression, real severe depression, severe melancholy, that isn't so often misdiagnosed, because you'll see some people just really retreat into this sort of severe sense of gloom and doom and just sort of pessimism. And if they don't have psychotic features with that depression, they're not as likely to be misdiagnosed, I don't think. We're talking about severe depression. You do get some, you know, changeover in diagnoses when there are some psychotic features. And what did happen in the U.S., this is an odd history. What happened in the U.S. is that the schizophrenia diagnosis definitely changed from about 1910 going forward. The original diagnosis for schizophrenia was a smaller diagnosis of patients that, yes, they were psychotic and they, you know, they had sort of these crazy symptoms, but they also had physical symptoms, sort of an inability to complete willed acts was a common symptom. And so there were a lot of psychotic patients who today would be diagnosed with schizophrenia who were not seen as ill with schizophrenia back in 1910 because doctors at that time were looking for this physical illness as well. The story gets complicated, but basically what happened is though that group of patients that presented with this physical, extreme physical debility and psychotic features basically disappeared from the group of patients entering asylums. And undoubtedly that was because a viral agent that was causing that group of patients no longer was around. And so what we got in the 1930s and 1940s was a look at a definition of a schizophrenia that really focused just on the psychotic symptoms and not so much on the physical sort of emotional withdrawal and all, and the physical inability to complete willed acts. And at that point, when you had that expansion of the diagnostic boundaries, many people who previously would have been in the manic depressive category were shunted into the schizophrenia category. So there was some real confusion of diagnosis that lasted really from about the 1930s to the early 1980s.
Mm. If a member of your family was suffering from what had been diagnosed as mental illness, I imagine you becoming an advocate for that person. Is this something that you've thought about? And if so, how would you work for that individual, for what was in that loved one's best interest?
This is a fantastic question, and it's also one of the most difficult things, I think, that can confront a family member, especially in the U.S. today. And let's talk about what do you do to help someone ill, say, with schizophrenia, the most severe disorder, because that can be so frightening, so difficult to deal with, and so you're just lost because of the change that may happen in your loved one. Here's the problem for the family member. There is so much misinformation out there about causes of schizophrenia and what the drugs do and don't do that it's really hard to get the best information. It's really hard to get sort of the honest information you need to start guiding your loved one. So frankly, I do think there needs to be some self-education and here's the dilemma. Our system is set up only to provide, really to provide medication, okay, and to keep people medicated. And that's what our health system is set up to do. There may be some auxiliary programs where to provide additional support, but really we're geared up to medicate and to keep a person medicated. Now, this leads to two problems, especially, you know, for family members and for the person, you know, who is so diagnosed and suffering in this way. The first problem is sometimes the people so diagnosed don't want to take the drugs, okay? Especially the old drugs were so painful, and it also made people sort of cut off from themselves and made them feel emotionally dead. We're talking about Haldol and Thorazine, that they very much resisted taking these drugs, and I think, honestly, often with good reason. And therefore, you got this break between family and the family member that could be so painful and push families apart. The first thing I would say to families is at least be willing to listen to a person today who is resistant to the medications, because if you dig into the literature, there often is a good reason for that, in that the patients who were most resistant to medications, researchers found, were actually the very group of patients most likely to do well without them. So if it's hard to listen in this situation for a family member, but, you know, listening even to that person who seems psychotic and disruptive and, you know, hearing voices, that doesn't mean that whatever they're experiencing isn't valid, and you need to listen to them, I believe. The second problem is this, and this is a story that I think is so just leaves families in a nowhere place. Long-term outcomes of these drugs haven't been good, and that's clear. We also see, like with this difference in outcomes between the poor and rich countries, where the outcomes are worse in the rich countries, where they keep patients on the drugs. There's a new study out by investigators at the University of Pennsylvania which found that over the course of 18 months, you get these changes in the brain, this enlargement of the basal ganglia, which is associated with a worsening of schizophrenia symptoms. Not an improvement, but a worsening, an underlying sort of change in the brain that makes people more biologically prone to psychosis. So the problem is this. You're left as a family member with a therapy that usually will produce a change in behavior that, at least over the short term, is good. In other words, it makes people, you know, calmer, more manageable, etc. But over the long term, there isn't good evidence for that these drugs lead people to recovery. And clearly, that's what you want for your loved one. You want your loved one to recover fully or as fully as possible and, you know, become employed again and have a social life. So I think today we leave families in an absolutely awful position of knowing what to do. And the problem is also that everything is filtered for patients today through a filter that says medication is an absolute necessity, and it way oversells the merits of the medication. So I think it's a really desperate situation for families.
I've got a number of listeners who want to talk with us this afternoon, but before we do that, I want to go back to schizophrenia and how it's treated in other parts of the world. Are the protocols the same from a place like, let's say, Nigeria to India to, you know, where else? I don't know.
Well, in a way, a lot of it's non-treatment in the sense that a patient, and again, in a way, this was looking at patients who in some ways had contact with Western clinics, because they would come into Western clinics in these WHO studies and get stabilized with the drugs. However, what the WHO researchers found, for example, in Nigeria, is the patients didn't even want to take the drugs, and their parents, the family members, had no belief in the drugs as well. So actually, few Nigerians were even bothering to take the pills. You will see, for example, in Nigeria, treatment with what they're called as cures of the sick heads, and it's, you know, sort of plant treatments, rituals, that sort of thing to drive out the evil spirit. The biggest thing, I think, though, is what they found is there's not as much isolation of the patient into sort of like institutions, a sort of separation from the society at large. So like the WHO will find that a year later the patients are living within the community, often with their families, and there's just not quite the segregation that occurs here. But there again, the biggest thing is it's seen as more episodic there, say in Nigeria, that you need to stabilize a person in whatever manner, whether it be with a drug or with some sort of ritual, but that you can recover, and that sort of therapeutic hope and belief seems to play out in, you know, over a period of a year or 2 years. One thing, however, there were three studies done in the 1970s when there was some here in the U.S. One was led by the head of schizophrenia studies at the NIMH, a gentleman named Lauren Mosher, that looked at what would happen to patients, what sort of spectrum outcomes would we see if, upon first admission, we randomized patients into non-drug arms and treated them with psychosocial care, shelter, food, empathy, that sort of thing, counseling, versus traditional medicated treatment. And what in each of those studies, what they found was that, and this is amazing, was that more than 50% of these first episode patients recovered and didn't relapse in extended follow-up periods that extended out to 3 years. And in each instance, in each of these three studies, the patients treated without medications upon first episode had better outcomes than those treated with the drugs. So, again, when you see, and this was this sort of experimentation where you don't initially expose people to the neuroleptics, as a matter of course, you get a percentage of people that basically do recover and get on with their lives and do well. And by the way, Finland just reported this in the year 2000, that about half the patients treated in this experimental manner did fine over a two-year period without neuroleptics and are back to working and suffering no psychotic symptoms.
Let's talk with some listeners now. First, we're going to go to Paris, Illinois, on the toll-free line, a listener there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We became conservators for our adult daughter, who has had problems for over 20 years. It became very severe, and she began having many different trials of different neuroleptics. They didn't seem to work at all, so I'm very interested in your resistant theory here, and we'll pursue that later. We are interested, however, in finding out what your experience and your studies have shown in the area of ECT for schizophrenia. She did have one series, course of five treatments for this, but then relapsed several months later. I'm wondering if you can tell us anything about your work with ECT and its results with drugs, alone, or what you have found out about it being as a cure and how long remission might last.
Sure. The history of ECT for schizophrenia is frankly a rather disturbing history. ECT is still used today more for depression. What happened was ECT came in the late 30s, 1930s, but it came in at a time there was a very odd therapeutic milieu, so to speak, going on in America's asylums. And basically the idea at that time was that the mentally ill had no chance of getting better, and there were some reasons they'd come to believe that. And at that time, they introduced into asylum medicine a quartet of therapies that were known to work by damaging the brain. These were insulin coma therapy, metrazole shock therapy, electroshock therapy, and prefrontal lobotomy. Now, electroshock at that time in the asylums was used basically with schizophrenia patients to quiet them, to make them more apathetic. There was some sense that if they would give them multiple shocks, 20, 30, 40, 50. And believe it or not, if you go into the medical journals at that time, the idea was you could reduce a person to a confused state. And in this confused state, frankly, they would be less of a bother to people running the asylums. it's spine tingling when you read this stuff.
We are familiar with that, and we know that it has been safely reduced to a shorter period.
Right, but here's the problem. Going first of all, in terms of, it usually is thought of more for depression today. But in terms of the relapse you talk about, is that's what, at least what I know, and I did not follow electroshock for schizophrenia forward to modern-day times. The reason was because drug therapy became the mainstay therapy for people with schizophrenia as opposed to depression. I will tell you, though, that even in depression you see this lifting of mood generally for, say, a month, but you do not see a benefit that really lasts beyond that, which has led to some speculation, and actually, this goes back to the 40s, that the mechanism at work there is that electroshock does cause trauma to the brain. In the 40s, they compared it to closed head injury, which is why you get the memory loss, closed head injury being like a concussion,
mm-hmm.
and that this causes a release of basically endorphins, adrenaline, that basically lift your mood. So it's the body's response to trauma is the reason you get this lifting in mood. But as the body recovers from that trauma, you basically, these internal sort of hormonal responses go back to normal and you relapse. That's what depresses. With schizophrenia, I don't know any good research showing that it's really good for long-term remission of psychotic symptoms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basic. I didn't follow it forward, but the thought was really that it wasn't a good treatment for schizophrenia. This is going forward from the 1950s.
Well, we sure appreciate your work in this field. We have two other children that have had short bouts with this problem, and interestingly enough, just as you reported, our one child who had absolutely no treatment except really good home comfort and a period of extended recovery alone made all the difference in the world, and he has had no problem since.
Well, that's the thing you see, and that's the thing, of course, that you want a form of medical care that allows that form of recovery, right?
Yes.
So you can see people really return to full lives.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, everything I've said before really is, what do you find in research literature, okay, rather than anecdotal accounts, because I tried in the book to just keep my focus on sort of these broad-based studies and all. I will tell you anecdotally, in terms of while I was doing research for this book and talking to patients and ex-patients, et cetera, the group that I know I'm going to get in trouble with this. The group that was really fully recovered, okay, that were the ex-patients that were off their meds. I'm not saying that going off your meds is always the answer, but you're certainly a group of people who got through their psychotic episodes and recovered and got off their meds. I mean, they're perfectly, you know, fine, normal, you know,
exactly. Alert,
et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I wouldn't want this talk to be a talk that says to everybody, take your loved ones off meds. And by the way, going off meds abruptly is a very dangerous thing.
Oh, we've seen that too. Now, I want to ask, is your book just out, or has it been out a while? We are practically advocates for this problem, as you can tell.
It's been out now a couple months. It came out in
January. Oh, well, we are going to look for that. That's Madness in America.
Mad in America, correct.
Mad in America. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Let's go next to a caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You touched on one of the questions I was going to ask about Lauren Mosher, but I'd like to ask, are you familiar, I'm sure you are, with the work of Ronnie Lang, Artie Lang?
Sure.
And could you comment on that? Or
well, I can, and Artie Lang, of course, Mosher actually...
Was a colleague of his.
That's right. So there was this sense, you know, Artie Lang in the 60s... And I did not investigate the Lang school at all, okay? But there was this thought that, you know, there could be healing through, you know, milieu therapy. And, you know, frankly, there was this thought from the Thomas Oz school that, you know, the myth of mental illness. And so there was sort of an anti-psychiatry movement, an anti-pills movement that R.D. Lang, you know, helped spearhead. Mosher was sort of... He was influenced by Lang. However, he was also Harvard Medical School trained doctor, and his disenchantment with meds came from his experience on wards, where he was running wards and he found that people kept on the neuroleptics like Haldol and Thorazine weren't getting well at all, and you know there wasn't this wonderful recovery that supposedly we were reading about, and he also found when he moved to the NIMH and became chief of schizophrenia studies there, he saw this sort of clubby relationship between leading researchers and the drug companies that sort of skewed, you know, made people sort of so much in favor of the drugs. And so he set up one of these experiments just to test, you know, could the non-drug therapy work? The reason I did not go into R.D. Lang is, you know, that's such a controversial thing. And I really wanted to see, based on the mainstream's own research, did it show that this form of care should be leading to better outcomes, or was there in our own research plenty of evidence to show why, you know, outcomes were so problematic here? And I'll give you an example. The NIMH, when it did its first sort of double-blind study, good controlled study of the neuroleptics, this came in the early 1960s, and this had four arms. Three groups got a different neuroleptic, and one group got placebo. And what they found is after 6 weeks, yeah, the drug-treated groups were doing better in terms of remission of psychosis than the placebo group. However, there was a number of placebo patients that were doing quite well. But here's the telling study, and that's the study that is even cited today showing the efficacy of neuroleptics. Then they did a one-year follow-up study of this group of 300 patients, and they found that the placebo-treated patients were less likely to be rehospitalized than any of the drug-treated groups. So what they had found at that point was that over time, something about use of the drugs was making people more chronically ill. There clearly was something going on, some biological change in the brain caused by the drugs that was leading to this increased chronicity. So rather than sort of explore R.D. Lang's theories and all, I wanted to see what was our mainstream research. Now here you have, these are really the starting studies for our use of these drugs and belief in these drugs. And yet, right from the outset, you see this chronicity problem.
I want to thank the caller for his call, and I want to go on. We've got a number of folks waiting for us, and time is growing short. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Champaign County on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. My sister teaches psych nursing, and I have been, in the past, I sort of gave up on it, arguing some of these points that you're making with her. And I think I'll have to send her a copy of your book, but I wanted to get back to this sort of criminal behavior, the ketamine dosing and that sort of thing. You're saying that went up until just 3 years ago?
Yeah, 1998.
How widespread was that? I mean, I don't know whether you... I think it needs emphasis because that's amazing that that this was done at all, and I'd like to know how widespread it was done.
Well, it was done by some of the best research institutions in the country. It was done at Yale, for example. It was done at the University of Cincinnati, for example. And it was done at the NIMH, for example. It was done at a hospital in Long Island, Hillside Hospital in Long Island. And there was easily more than 1,000 patients from 1970s forward put into these experiments. And that's the number of patients you can count up just from reported results. And as you know, there's always more people put into these experiments than you just see in the research literature. So was it widespread? Yes, it was seen as sort of a mainstream approach to studying psychosis in the mentally ill, so much so that in 1990, and University of Maryland was reporting this, by the way, was doing this as well. And you would see reports, say, in 1996, 1997, 1998, where they would basically take a patient, a person coming into a hospital for help, and they would give them amphetamine or methylphenidate or ketamine, and so they could take pictures of the brain as it became ever more psychotic. It is the most stunning abandonment of the mentally ill that you can imagine. And it shows a disregard, clearly shows a disregard of these people as people. And it shouldn't even have been done even if they were telling people what they were going to do, because no one comes into an emergency room looking to have his or her symptoms be made worse. But the fact that you see this pattern of lying in the informed consent forms, which I obtained through Freedom of Information requests, just makes the experimentation all that much worse. And by the way, it accelerated in the 1990s. The number of these experiments increased in the 1990s as we got new tools to image the brain.
It's really ghastly. It seems like they're desperate to prove something, and maybe what they're desperate to prove is, the emperor has no clothes. This idea that you can't even show with their own current documentation that it's doing any good. My understanding, and I was arguing with people who are teaching this clinical stuff about mainly pill maintenance, mainly prescription maintenance. Peter Bregan's Talking Back to Prozac was sort of an informant for that. And I still think that's probably a fairly good source to go to. But schizophrenia, the whole use of ECT was originally theoretically because there was a low correlation between epileptics and schizophrenia from Charcot's studies, and then it just grew on itself. It supposedly was effective. But you're saying that even in the 50s, it was known basically that it worked by damaging basically. And you gave insulin shock and was it metrazine?
Metrazole convulsive therapy, right?
That's a drug induced convulsion, right?
Right. Actually, electroshock was just seen as an easier way. You're right. There was this theory that epilepsy and schizophrenia were mutually antagonistic, right? And therefore, initially they tried to drive out schizophrenia by inducing seizures with metrazole, okay? And then electroshock became an easier, more convenient way to cause these seizures. However, away from that sort of a theory, which was quickly shown not to be, true, there was open acknowledgement that what they were going after was what was called brain-damaging therapeutics. And that was a term coined by Walter Freeman, for example, who was the big guru for lobotomy. But you would see, they would meet and talk about all these therapies work by damaging the brain, and maybe lobotomy is the best because it has the most precise mechanism for damaging the brain. And electroshock in the 1940s, this is before sort of when people were actually more open about this, they regularly talked about how electroshock clearly worked in some manner by harming the brain, damaging the brain.
We're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today, and we have all the phone lines lit up. Perhaps we'll get together again. But in the meantime, this question begs to be asked. Where are the regulators? And we don't have, you'll have to, I can only give you a soundbite here.
The regulators fell asleep at the job. In terms of the experimentation, they fell asleep at the job. In terms of looking at the long-term outcomes with medications, there's just not the discerning sort of critical approach that is needed, and frankly, it's because of the influence of drug money.
Hmm. And what's been the reaction to the book from the field of psychiatry, from the AMA?
Well, from the field of psychiatry, it's been mixed, oddly enough, in the sense that I've heard from a number of psychiatrists who've written me these very nice letters saying, thank God you've written this book, and it's a book that we believe in, has needed to be written for 40 years, 30 years, and it sort of confirms what we've seen in our clinical practice. However, those at the very top of American psychiatry and those who consult to the drug industry, drug companies, are furious with me and, you know, have been, you know, very angry and have written sort of nasty reviews.
Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon, and maybe we'll talk again.
Great. Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Robert Whitaker has been our guest this afternoon. He's a medical journalist. He's written a book that is titled Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. The book is published by Perseus.